From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Kinnairy. Florida Gulf Coast University's 2025-26 Provost Seminar Series kicked off last Friday with renowned infectious disease expert Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's considered to be one of the nation's foremost experts in infectious diseases. He's dedicated his career to advancing global efforts to prepare and respond to emerging infectious disease threats. Dr. Osterholm's leadership and expertise has guided policymakers, health professionals, and the public through some of our most challenging health crises. He is Regents Professor, McKnight Presidential Endowed Chair in Public Health, the Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, Distinguished Teaching Professor in the Division of Environmental Health Sciences in the School of Public Health, a professor in the Technological Leadership Institute in the College of Science and Engineering, and an adjunct professor in the medical school, all at the University of Minnesota. In November 2020, Dr. Osterholm was appointed to President-elect Joe Biden's 13-member transition COVID-19 advisory board. Prior to that, he served as a science envoy for health security on behalf of the U.S. Department of State. We normally interview speakers for the Provost Seminar Series in studio while they're on campus to talk, but we're kicking off this year with a special on-location recording of a conversation with Dr. Osterholm and Dr. Steve Mason. He's a cardiologist and a member of the Naples Discussion Group's Executive Committee. The discussion group partners with FGCU on the lecture series. Today we're airing a version of the recording from Friday that's trimmed for time reasons. You can hear it in its entirety on our website, wgcu.org/gcl. We begin with the news that broke that morning of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's vaccine advisors' decision to narrow the agency's hepatitis B immunization guidance for newborns.
I've now been in this business almost 51 years, and I've seen a lot of public health challenges come and go. During that time, I served every presidential administration in a formal role, dating back to Ronald Reagan and HIV/AIDS and the 1980s AIDS Commission. In the Trump 1 administration, I was a science envoy for the State Department, trying to get the world better prepared for a forthcoming pandemic, which arrived a year and a half later, and not sure we did such a good job. I was on the Biden-Harris transition team on COVID. I also, in the 51 years, split that time period between being at the University of Minnesota and at the Minnesota Department of Health. I served for a number of those years as a state epidemiologist. And so I served two Republican governors, two Democratic governors, and as we like to say, one independent wrestler, Jesse Ventura, who was governor. And no one could tell you my partisan politics. My job has always been to call balls and strikes. That's it, just balls and strikes. And that's what I'll do today. And so everything's fair game, and I'll cover it as such. And I think that's an important context because today we've gotten so partisan that sometimes it's very difficult to separate out why is someone saying something versus what they're saying. And I think this is a huge challenge. So now you know where I'm at. This was very hard for me to talk about. Today, I watched our country lose 140 years of public health by the actions taken by this administration and the Advisory Immunization Practices, an outside group to the CDC that basically provides expert input on vaccines. As Steve noted, I did, in fact, write an op-ed piece in the New York Times a week and a half after the election and said, because I understood Mr. Kennedy very well and I knew the role that he was going to be playing in the administration, that, in fact, this group wanted to take our vaccines away from us. There has been a history to that in terms of the advisory immunization practices all being fired, a whole new group of people who came in with really not only no expertise, but a very specific anti-vaccine node to them. Imagine if you took a group of flat earthers and put them in charge of NASA. That's basically what we have today, right now, with what we've seen. And what they voted on today was to eliminate the universal hepatitis B influenza dose for newborns, which until 1991, we had thousands and thousands of cases of hepatitis B every year in this country associated with an infected mom transmitting the virus to the baby during delivery. And we learned very quickly that if you could vaccinate that child within hours of that delivery and give them immune globulin, you could over 90-some percent of the time stop that transmission from occurring. the Chinese, which for years had the highest rate of cancer, of any kind of cancer in the world, hepatocellular carcinoma, cancer of the liver, all tied to this issue, have virtually eliminated it out of their current generation of individuals for this very approach. Why everyone should get it? They say if my mom, if they know that the mom might be negative, because our healthcare system is such a mess that we can't count on records being available. We can't count on follow-up taking place like you can in some countries. And so the only way to make this different was to, in fact, put into place this universal vaccine issue. We estimate that over 6 million kids and hospitalizations have been saved since 1991 when this was put into place. We know that the vast majority of these kids who are infected by 20 to 30 years into their life, well over half of them will basically have major cirrhosis of the liver or hepatocellular carcinoma. Today, if you want to know about cost, liver transplants about $320,000. And today, the ACIP, this Advisory Committee on Asian Practices, despite all the data, and our group just put out a major report on it, over 400 studies dating back 40 years with a vaccine that is the highest safety profile of any vaccine we have, there has been no serious reactions with this vaccine. None. Zero. It's highly effective, and yet this group voted to end that, which also means that the very funding for this may be jeopardized because one of the requirements of the Vaccine for Children's program, which a lot of these kids were vaccinated with those vaccines, basically means that it has to be recommended by the ACIP. And now that it's not going to be recommended, we have payers that may not very well pay for it. You know, how many parents are going to be able to afford a couple $100 vaccine, basically, at birth when they can't afford anything? And so this was a major step. And today, all I can say is we have taken a step from where in this nation, we are not being ruled in a sense from the science issues on science. It's based on ideology. And as far as I'm concerned, the U.S. federal government, as of this day, has fully disqualified itself from any future advising, and we cannot take any of it seriously. So that's very hard for me to say because I still have many, many dear colleagues at CDC, people who have dedicated their lives to public health, many research colleagues who have done the same, who now basically are in a position of no longer can be counted on because of the leadership of these organizations are where they're at. So don't know if that was the answer you're looking for, Steve, but I got to tell you, it's an emotional moment for me today to actually say to myself, our country no longer can be counted on to provide scientific information. We are going to have to figure out somehow we're going to get this information otherwise.
This is just what pops into my head. You know, turning a ship that big is, you know, not quick. There's been lots of institutional knowledge lost from what I understand. So not only are the policies being made that are disruptive, like you've just described, I guess my question is that if a bunch of people leave who are the ones who know things, even if we were to have a new administration, how possible is it to get to a place where we can trust the health officials again? Or is this something that's, you know, going to be entrenched for a while?
Well, again, let me provide a little bit of context to that. You know, I have not always agreed to CDC on every issue, but they were always based on the nuances of the science. It wasn't about intent or it wasn't about, you know, the idea that we're trying to cover something up or not. And so in a sense, CDC did not need to be cut apart. When DOGE was put into place, I can tell you that no one would have devised a program like that that ever thought they're going to get an MBA, because nobody would ever buy that as an MBA project. What they did basically is took a chainsaw, literally, to these agencies without understanding who they were cutting, where they were cutting it, or how much they were cutting. There was no stated purpose. There was no understanding of what that was. And so when you have an agency like CDC where you've lost 20,000 people, all of a sudden, did they have critical jobs? Were they really important to what we know in this country? Nobody knew in the sense of what programs were done. The same thing is true with funding, although the funding has come back in a number of areas of the federal government because the court orders is still on the line for what basically in this country public health has provided. And let me just give you a sense of today in the United States, for infectious diseases, while are on the front lines of state and local public health agencies, on average, over 90% of all the funding for local and state public health comes from the federal government through the CDC. Those funds are completely in jeopardy. We're not only seeing the federal government eroded substantially, but state and local. And so we will one day rebuild. I have no doubt about that. We need to build back better. This will not continue, but it could continue for some time. And in the meantime, the destruction, I think, to the actual system is going to be so substantial that the rebuild is going to be difficult. You know, as somebody who has spent my whole career in higher education, I've had over 280 graduate students. You know, I've had a whole number of PhD students. It breaks my heart to watch how many of them lost their jobs in the last 6 months, just arbitrarily lost their jobs. And for no reason, nobody could articulate you weren't doing what you needed to be done. You weren't helping the public's health. It's just, we'll cut here, we'll cut there, okay? Now, having said that, we're not even sure yet what we need to rebuild back because we're still suffering the losses of what's been happening here. And, you know, let me just say, like, an example where CDC is at today. In the end of last month, unannounced, the former Surgeon General of Louisiana was brought in as the new deputy director at CDC. We had a previous director that had been Senate approved, the first time ever Senate approved because of a new law that went through last year that said that the CDC directors now had to be Senate approved, who was on the job for just days before, depending on who story listened to, the Mr. Kennedy's or hers, one was fired, one left on their own. And so that we need a director at CDC, but no one will ever get confirmed through the Senate now. I mean, I can tell you that to put a candidate up that would actually meet the requirements, I think, of the Senate is none. So now this person I just talked about, the Surgeon General of Louisiana, is the deputy director, which makes them by de facto the number one person at CDC. This is a person who has been the largest prescriber of opioids in the state of Louisiana. This is a person who has been a highly efficient, quote-unquote, prescription writer for ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine for COVID, which we've shown is that. This is a individual who sat on top of a pertussis outbreak in Louisiana after four deaths in kids, still did not report it to the public, and was only accidentally leaked out that, in fact, it ever got to be known that there was this huge whooping cough outbreak in Louisiana. This is an individual that has continued to talk about how the vaccines that we have killed people and caused cancer. That's the head of the CDC right now. I mean, whether you believe that vaccines are important or not, you have to admit that this is a dangerous time when we have so many challenges that we should be in this kind of a position. So to build back will in part be determined to how much destruction is yet to occur. And I think it's just getting started. Final conclusion, this was a story that was in Politico last week. I've been talking about it a lot in the last 6 months, 7 months. The real plan here is the way to get rid of vaccines is not to take them off the market. Make the market take them off. What do I mean? Well, it turns out that the administration has already come forward in a website change at CDC 3 weeks ago and said that autism now is likely caused by vaccines, which we have absolutely incredible data showing that that's not true. Remarkable data. And they're going to add the autism spectrum to a program known as the Vaccine Injury Court, basically. It's a program that was set up where 85 cents of every dose of a vaccine made is put aside for a fund for people who are legitimately injured by vaccines, which can happen. Well, if you put the autism spectrum now in the Injury Compensation Court, basically it'll bankrupt it. When it bankrupts it, the only other option then is to go sue the companies. Well, the five companies that make childhood vaccines have already made it clear they can't survive with the risk that will happen to them for your mumps, measles, rubella vaccine. They will get out of the business. We will not have a time we have to worry about the recommendations. We'll have a time we have to worry about where the hell is the damn vaccine. We're not going to have it in this country. At least you think that I'm being extreme. Just all the things we've talked about today with hepatitis, when I talked about that 5 months ago, people said, it won't happen. They won't fire the ACIP. So this is a really dramatic moment. And so I know we're here to talk about pandemics today. We'll get to that. But when you pretty much when your whole clothes are on fire, it's even a problem to think about your house burning down, okay? Basically, we are in a house on fire moment, but now it's preceded by all my clothes are on fire too. And that's what we've got to deal with.
Thank you. So let me step back to the pandemic and what we may not have done right then, and how we can plan better for the next one, because Mike will convince you that the next one's coming, only a matter of when. So in anticipating a pandemic, just like military planning, Mike has written, in any conflict, we start off by fighting the last war to study what worked and what didn't. To quote General Eisenhower, planning is essential. So there were three viral epidemics in the 20 years before COVID. Two of them were coronaviruses, SARS and MERS, and one was influenza H1N1 in 2009. Why didn't these viral infections cause worldwide pandemics?
Well, first of all, a pandemic is by its definition a worldwide epidemic. It occurs typically quickly around the world. Historically, we always thought that pandemics were caused by influenza viruses. And remember, in virologic time, we're very new. You know, it's only been literally in the last 100 years that we've been in a position of better understanding what viruses might be. And we were received a rude awakening with the COVID situation, but it was a warm-up that occurred actually twice before. One was 2003, where we actually had cases of severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, which was caused by a coronavirus. This particular outbreak, which started in China, we had clear evidence was a spillover into an animal population, into humans. And it was one that killed 15 to 20% of the people that got it. But fortunately, the vast majority of people were not that infectious. And so we could contain it. A few super spreaders did create some challenges, but with time, we contained all of it. As I speak today, there are two new cases here in the Americas from people who just returned from Saudi Arabia with a coronavirus infection from camels. That is the second one that occurred was in 2012, was MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. That was a similar kind of virus situation, except it evolved on the Arabian Peninsula in camels and ended up infecting humans, basically spread out of the Saudi Arabia, Arabian Peninsula region to other parts of the world. Again, we had the same challenges where the vast majority of people were not highly infectious, but a few were and caused some real challenges stopping that transmission. When I say stopping that transmission, I'm talking about a virus with wings, a virus that's a respiratory transmitted virus. Right now, if I had an infection due to large droplets, not aerosols, droplets, they would all be falling out within 6 feet of me. I'd nail these two guys. Maybe I'd nail a couple of you in the front row here, okay? But that's it. But my aerosols are knocking all of you off in the back of the room. And that's how they float. The next time you walk down the street and you suddenly smell cigarette smoke and you look up and you see the person a good, 30 feet away from you, 40 feet away from you, it's a situation where that's an aerosol. That's what you're smelling, is that kind of thing. I tell the story, that, Steve, that we really understood aerosols in Minnesota very well when we had an outbreak that occurred at the Special Olympics. The International Special Olympics were held in the Twin Cities. And in the opening night ceremony, there were 64,000 people in the stands in this baseball field area. And there was all the teams that were part of the Special Olympics came marching in from the right field area. There was a door that came out. And by the time they all kind of came out and arranged themselves, they covered the entire baseball playing field. And the teams were then by alphabet order, and the Argentines basically were right on home plate. And it turned out there was a young boy from Argentina, 12 years old, who was just breaking with measles. And he transmitted to a number of people in the event, meaning that throughout the next 14 days of the Special Olympics, and then we had a small outbreak there. We had not had indigenous measles in Minnesota in the previous 5 years. Suddenly, we started picking up these cases who had nothing to do with the Special Olympics except one thing. They were there at the opening night session. And it turned out that they all sat in one section of the event, and they did not know each other. This section happened to be 425 feet away from home plate where this young boy sat. When we did the air studies and looked at this, the air basically was blowing out of the back of the air wall behind home plate and literally bounced from there all the way up to the exit fan up at 425 feet away, and it nailed everyone in that section who had not previously been vaccinated or who had not previously had measles, 425 feet away. So that's a virus with wings. And that's the kind of thing that is really important to understand why transmission is really important with this in a pandemic. Once it starts, it's gone. You can't stop it. And that's why we have to be better prepared for it as such. And one that at this point, we will have another influenza pandemic. 1918 was the horrible one that still was far worse than what we saw with COVID. If you look at MERS and SARS right now, SARS continues to kill 15 to 20% of the people that get it. MERS kills up to 35% of the people that get it. We now have found viruses in the wild, in bats, that actually have the same capability of transmission we saw with SARS, or excuse me, with COVID, where we're talking now about a 1% case fatality rate, but highly infectious. These new viruses have that, plus they have the package on board to kill, like MERS and SARS. And they're in the wild. It's just a matter of time before that jumps. Now imagine, instead of going through what we did at 1% case fatality rate, it was 35%. Imagine what that would be like. And that's a reality. Influenza, same thing. I just have to offer one last piece on the influenza side, just to orient you to this issue. The one thing that will save us in the next pandemics is if we have much better vaccines available almost at the word go. And I can tell you right now, if we had an influenza pandemic emerge, the capability that we have is so limited because we're still growing influenza virus for our vaccines in embryated chicken eggs, the same methods we used in the 1950s. Today, we could grow about enough virus in the first year of the pandemic to vaccinate less than 20% of the world. That would be it. Well, guess what? We have a possible solution. mRNA technology, what you use for COVID, is a remarkable technology. Despite all of the negative things that have been said about it, it is remarkable technology, highly effective and safe. Well, we were able to get the last administration to put $500 million into a program to develop influenza-based mRNA vaccines that were to be available instead of having this scenario where you see basically only 20% of the world's population being protected in a year. We could probably do the whole world within a year with mRNA technology. The difference between those two scenarios are millions and millions and millions of deaths. This administration summarily took all that money away. There is no work going on right now in mRNA technology in Health and Human Services, trying to get us prepared for better COVID vaccines or coronavirus in general, better influenza vaccines. And so again, this is a lesson about the future. And we said in there, you should go look back and learn. We haven't. We did not. We aren't. And that, I think, is the challenge we have today. So again, while we have an immediate crisis at the moment, we can't forget about these long-term issues either, because one day they're going to sneak up on us. And all of a sudden, we're going to ask ourselves, how do we get to this place?
Today, we're listening to an edited version of a conversation I had on Friday on the Florida Gulf Coast University campus with Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's director of the Centers for Infectious Disease Research and the Policy Research and Innovation Office at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Osterholm has dedicated his career to advancing global preparation and response to emerging infectious threats. His new book is The Big One is Still Coming, Lessons We Should Have Learned from the COVID-19 Pandemic, which teed up our conversation as part of FGCU's Provost's Seminar Series. I was joined on stage by Dr. Steve Mason. He's a cardiologist and member of the Naples Discussion Group's Executive Committee. They partner with FGCU on this lecture series. You can hear the full version of this event on our website, wgcu.org/GCL.
Your book's been out for, 2 months, 3 months? The new one?
A couple months, I think.
When was the last opportunity you had to make changes to it?
Early January.
Yeah.
So one of the problems writing a book, you have to get all of it done. And if it's a current affairs thing, you're always saying, oh my God, I can't do it now. All this has happened.
So I think the obvious question then is, if you're offering things that we could use from what we learned in the first pandemic, if there's another one, how does the things that you've described in terms of the challenges we're facing at CDC and, National Institutes of Health and Human Services,
very important question. Let me just point out, first of all, that my real hope or dream was that we would have a review of the previous pandemic. Right after 9/11, I was asked by Secretary Tommy Thompson, who then at Health and Human Services, to come and help prepare the country for a possible bioterrorism event, which the anthrax thing did happen. I had written a book that was published in 2017, ironically on September 1st, okay, of 2017. And a year later, I think I bought 18 of the 20 copies that were sold, okay? But then when 9/11 happened, it became a New York Times bestseller. And so Secretary Thompson said, would you please come and help? So I split my time between Minnesota and HHS. And it was a remarkable time. It was why I got to work on SARS and MERS, because I was still at HHS. But what was really impressive to me was watching the bipartisan 9/11 commission come together. It was led by a very respected Republican and a very respected Democrat. It was no holes barred, but no finger pointing. Nobody to blame. What should we have known? What could we have known? What can we know for the future? What lessons should have been learned? That report still stands the test of time as having been an amazing exercise in preparing for that type of event going forward in the future. And a number of us have urged both the previous administration, the Biden administration, the Trump administration, we need a hot wash on what happened in the pandemic so that we can learn for the future. And it can't boil back down to, was it a lab leak or was it an intentional release that way, or was it an animal spillover? And that's where we're at today. We're all stuck on that. That's all people want to talk about. Well, come on. It could be a lab leak in the future. It could be an animal spillover in the future. Either way, we got to get prepared. Let's move on. We're not. So I had the good fortune, because enough of the lessons we did learn early enough, they are in the book. A good example was the fact that early on, I wrote an op-ed piece in March of 2020, and the Washington Post said, do not do lockdowns. Do not do lockdowns. They will not work. And they were approaching this as you all might think of approaching it, because they were thinking like a hurricane. You know, it's going to last for 16, 24, 36 hours, but then we can go into recovery. That with a pandemic, it's going to last years. It's going to last years. And I think people just didn't have that mindset. On March 10th of 2020, I was on Joe Rogan's podcast, and I said I thought that there could easily be some 800,000 deaths in the next 18 months. You might have thought I was calling your mother some really bad name, because people just didn't want to, even my own colleagues didn't want to embrace that. 18 months later, we were 790,000 deaths. And that challenge was, well, what can you do? What do you mean? And we could do a lot. And what I had proposed, that why you don't want to do lockdowns, is because you're going to stay like this for 3 years. Are you going to have everything so suppressed for 3 years? You can't exist that way. It won't happen. So what else can you do? Well, the most important tool we had to reduce the number of deaths and improve outcomes was to have an adequate medical care system, which already was challenged before COVID. But what could we do? And if your hospital is at a census of 140%, where people are sleeping in the hallways and in the parking stall garages, you know your system is not providing good medical care. And so what if we could just keep shaving down that number of hospitalizations and make sure we have good medical care and put into place a thing called snow days? We in Minnesota know them really well. And what we would do basically is every day your hospital had to post this hospital census. And you could know we're at 110% or we're at 80%. We could make recommendations, say, now's not the time to have a meeting like this. Now is the time to think about closing school for 2 weeks. Now is the time to do things where you bring that back down. And you're going to be riding this wave throughout the entire pandemic. But every time the public would know why it was people were being asked to do what they were doing, and they could see the results, okay? So, you know, we put that out as a something that we should be doing, as opposed to the idea of lockdowns. Well, 41 states enacted lockdowns. Unfortunately, many of them were kind of like Minnesota's, though. And in this case, the governor basically said, put an emergency declaration out, only essential workers could go to work, okay? Well, the problem was 82% of our workforce is deemed essential workers, okay? Come on, is that a lockdown? And there's been this perpetuated myth ever since then that there was a lockdown that lasted for on and on. Of those 41 states that had lockdowns in the end of March, by June, only one state continued to have one. Now, a lot of locals made decisions, school districts made decisions, restaurants made decisions. A lot of other places did decide for the sake of, because either the public was so frightened to be there or that they did take into place and say, no, we're not doing this, this is closed down. But that was not a national or statewide lockdown that was happening in those cases. And I think that's been unfortunate. So there's an example of one thing we could have done. What if we had merely put into place snow days? We could have, I think, clearly kept those peaks of cases down. We could have kept the healthcare system much more manageable, and people could actually see my actions matter because we're bringing the number back down. So that's an example. And I have a whole series of those kind of examples in the book that actually say, this would be something planned for the future. Don't talk about lockdowns, you know, do this.
Seems to me that during COVID, especially toward the first year or so, one of the main criticisms would be about the guidance would change. And my question was that a lack of good communication from the officials? You know, because as you are well aware, the nature of science is that there is change as new information comes along. Yeah. So it seems to me that, you know, it's a lack of understanding as to how science works on one side, but also a lack of effective communication on the other side. Where do those twain meet?
They meet with a whole lot of other factors that come all meet together. Let me, first of all, just affirm for you, there were clearly communication issues, and I'll come to that. The second thing, though, is that there was a partisan nature that came together here with this situation that we really hadn't thought through or anticipated. You know, I wrote a book in 2017, Deadliest Enemies, Our War Against Killer Germs, which, like my first book, sold okay copies, but it wasn't until the pandemic came the New York Times bestseller. And in that book, I laid out in three chapters what a pandemic would look like. And if you will read it, it looks pretty much like what happened with COVID, except I called it an influenza virus. The one thing I hadn't put in there is the partisan nature. And what happened was, with the lockdowns and this perceived issue of mandates with vaccines, the vaccine became a surrogate almost for a political statement. And that challenge in of itself made it so that communication wasn't just about science. It was, how do you explain to people about this partisan nature? And how many people in red states and blue states ultimately died from COVID that could have been likely saved from a vaccine made that messaging really challenging. But let me give you an example of how we could have worked through some of that. I was unsuccessful in getting this effort considered, but in retrospect, when the first data came out in the mRNA vaccines saying that basically there was a 95-97% protection at 2 months, people immediately went, oh my God, this is incredible. We're done. We're safe. Okay. Just get my two doses of vaccine and I'm fine. Well, you know, I had worked with SARS and MERS before, as I had shared, and saw what coronaviruses do. And one of the things that they're very notable for is waning immunity, meaning, yeah, you can get protection those first few months, whether it's a vaccine or it's actual illness, but they wane over time. And so I suggest that, you know, what we should do is follow the cohorts of individuals who are in these studies. And then those who had been originally vaccinated, then all the placebos did get vaccine, okay? And what if every month we put out a number and said, this month, only 87% of people have protective effectiveness, okay? And the third month, it was 78%. And the fourth month, it was 65%. The people would see it right in front of them. And we would say, you know, we may need a booster someday, but now you can see the data. It's right there. What we're doing is we're following that. And if that had happened instead of the summer of 2021, when suddenly large numbers of people who had thought they were fully protected weren't and got COVID, they were angry. They said, wait a minute. And what if we had just shared with them, this is what we know so far, and this is what we might have to do if we get to this level. But on the other hand, if it stays high and the protection is good, this is great. You know, I've always believed in public health, you could never over-communicate, never. That's an example, I think, of what we could have done that would have taken one of the huge issues off the table of you lied to me about the vaccine. And nobody did lie. I don't believe they did. Nobody intentionally tried to mislead the public about these vaccines. It's just we hadn't thought through enough how to communicate a rapidly changing situation with a body of data that was being built day by day by day. A good example is, again, I was not popular. You probably think, what the hell would they invite me here? I'm so unpopular. But I wrote an op-ed piece in the Minneapolis Star Tribune newspaper in the summer 2021 urging that we not mandate COVID vaccines. And they go, what? Well, I've always believed very much that vaccines are, in a sense, a public health miracle. And when you have childhood vaccines like mumps, measles, and rubella, where you get lifetime protection, you stop from getting infected, you don't transmit the virus to others, all these benefits that are there, I can mandate those in a heartbeat. Okay? Every bit as much as a seatbelt or a car seat or any number of things, okay? Because they do all those things. I've, for a long time, as big a supporter of influenza vaccine as you can find, but I'd never mandate it. Why? Because people still get infected. They still transmit the virus. And you can't say you're vaccinating to try to stop transmission. You may dampen it somewhat, but it's still there. But you can encourage that. And I kept saying, you know, if we had this situation with COVID, what if we had said, no, don't mandate, but basically do whatever we can to convince people to get vaccinated? And we had a situation where they had a mandate in place for Minnesotans, particularly at the University of Minnesota, in the summer of 2021. And they were going to mandate you get vaccine, except you could opt out for personal reasons, which made no sense in a sense. I mean, if you really opt out or not. And I thought to myself, you know, if you get somebody to declare they're not going to take it for personal philosophical reasons, you're never going to get them back. You know, they've crossed the line. What if you don't mandate it? You keep working with them, showing them the data, showing them why it's so important, you know? And this is somebody here you're looking at who's lost three good friends to COVID, all because they refused to be vaccinated, and they subsequently got infected and died. You know, I saw that firsthand. And so I think there's another example of just how messaging and how we have to think about, you know, if I had a COVID vaccine today that had all the attributes of mumps, measles, rubella vaccine, I'd want to mandate it. But I'd have an explanation why and what it did and why it was different than the vaccines that don't do that.
We want to get to your questions, but let us cover a couple of significant points. So from the standpoint of an aerosolized virus with wings in terms of prevention, your book states the mask message in the United States was so muddled as to be meaningless. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, first of all, early on, everybody wanted to do something. And we had, for the very lack of a better way to describe it, hygiene theater kick in. Remember all that plexiglass you saw? That stuff was meaningless. We spent millions and millions and millions of dollars on things that made no difference. Those aerosols jumped up around or other. If it was droplets, it would have been different, okay? You couldn't convince people that they had to do something. Then when we got into respiratory protection, we had people making masks, you know, people who were sewing literally 18 hours a day at home to help make masks for people. I so appreciated their intent and their efforts, but they made no difference. It turns out that a virus is so highly infectious like this, you need to use what we call an N95 respirator, or some people call it a mask. This works effectively because of the fact, first of all, it's a very tight face fit. When's the last time you used swim goggles that it leaked in the lens and not in the side, okay? So you got to have a tight face fit. But if a tight face fit, how do you breathe? Because you got to get air through all of that, okay? And that could be a real challenge. Well, it turns out that N95s are made by what's called melt-blown material. And this material is almost like you'd see in a type of ventilation filter system that basically filters out things from electrostatic charge. So the material that's around your face actually is porous enough to let air move through relatively easily. But if the virus tries to get in, or any particle tries to get in, it stops it with this electrostatic charge. That is so different than a cloth mask or a bandana, which basically never, you know, either had to be able to breathe or not breathe. And if you didn't breathe, you were dead. If you could breathe, you know, the virus could get in. And so what we needed to have done is really done a much better job explaining that. And there's a whole group of us in the medical area that tried very hard to get that message out. unfortunately, it was some of our colleagues that were the most loud about, no, this isn't true. It's aerosols, isn't it? That's kind of thing. And we went into that. I had three different experiences during the pandemic where in hospitals in the Twin Cities area where I went to for work-related issues, I walk in the front door and I'm stopped. And they're telling me I have to take off my fitted N95 and put on a surgical mask because that's their standard of practice. I said, well, I don't think so, okay? But it was a hospital that was supposed to be protecting patients and protecting workers, and they had an inferior protection that was not going to work. And so we needed to do a lot of work on this. We have the data to actually show what an N95 respirator can do in the context of close contact with someone or someone with just a regular old mask on. And it's a huge, huge difference.
This is an edited version of a conversation I had last Friday at FGCU as part of the university's provost seminar series with Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and the Policy Research and Innovation Office at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Osterholm's leadership and expertise has guided policymakers, health professionals, and the public through some of our most challenging health crises for decades. His latest book, published in September, is The Big One Is Still Coming, Lessons We Should Have Learned from the COVID-19 Pandemic. I was also joined by Dr. Steve Mason. He's a cardiologist and a member of the Naples Discussion Group's Executive Committee. They partner with FGCU on this lecture series. You can hear the full version of this event on our website, wgcu.org/GCL.
Both myself, Dr. Cherm, and myself were family nurse practitioners here in Lake County. And I remember, and I don't know if you had that same similar situation, but when we had, then they gave us the N95 to work with. So I worked the COVID unit and he was amongst the people. We had to be fitted for it. And I was just curious on how that will be if the next pandemic comes, how that barrier will come down for the general public. Because I felt guilty sometimes wearing this awesome mask and people around me didn't have access to it.
Well, you had to use what you could, first of all, and thank you for that. I would say, quite honestly, not to pick on your colleague here, but if you have facial hair, you totally lose the seal on your N95. And so one of the areas you had to do was be willing to shave, okay? And that was an important part of that. But I think the real point of this was the fact that we will have a fair number of N95s on hand at the next pandemic opening, because 90%+ of the use in N95s is not for infectious diseases. It's in commercial operations, manufacturing right now for all the other things that chemical and so forth that someone might be exposed to. So it's an active market. One of the things that I feel very good about, the night of January 20th, when we declared that this was going to be the next pandemic, I actually met with senior officials from 3M and said, guys, you can take it for what it's worth, but this is going to go. And the next day they opened every line they had in the world. And they actually brought N95s to the market much faster than anybody else could. The problem was, is at that time, the administration decided that this should be a state-by-state purchase. We shouldn't coordinate it. And it made it a feeding frenzy. It was terrible. We had states trying to outbid other states, et cetera. We weren't trying to prioritize. If one state could buy 95% of the supply, they wanted it because they wanted to have it on hand and stored, okay? And so one of the other areas that's going to be important is also having the coordination so that it's equitable sharing, moving this, the N95s out so everybody has it. And that's going to be a lot of education to people. We will need to have more people who are trained, and you can surely do this, trained on how to do a face fit so that and that's going to be an important part of this. That's what we should be planning for now. How do you create your basic team now of face fitting experts that can help out? And so just as we had so many healthcare providers that stepped forward to help do vaccination clinics, wouldn't it be nice if we had similar ones for N95s? Last point I'd make, they still are cumbersome. They still get dirty. And one of the areas we recommended in the book, we need a new major initiative to come with a better N95, one that's washable, one that basically fits better, one that, you can actually feel like you're not too claustrophobic in it. Nothing's been done. What a waste of time.
Do you think that there could have been a different response in the United States to the pandemic if the political, maybe not the political faction would have been different at that time in the leaders, but that politics would have stayed out?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the question because I think it highlights a very important area. One of the things that will happen in a pandemic is politics will never stay out. Plan for it. Okay? It'll happen. It's human nature. But the question is, how can you handle the politics? And we're not necessarily in the same time and place as we were with HIV/AIDS. But I can tell you, one of the most memorable moments of my career was back in 1984, when the Senate Majority Leader and the House of Representatives Chair in our Minnesota legislature called a four-hour mandatory meeting for everyone and their staffs. And I lectured for 4 hours in HIV/AIDS. And we never had one bad bill submitted in our state legislature through the duration of HIV/AIDS. And it was putting it into a context where there didn't need to be, you know, red versus blue or whatever. And, you know, we set it up, you know, between the issue with mandates, lockdowns, school closings, people perceived it was a political issue right there. And I mean, just so some of the things I shared with you today, I hope you could see how they might have depoliticized things. If in fact that hospital number was the hospital numbers, it didn't matter if you're Democrat, Republican, you know, you were part of the High Moon Party, whatever, you know, it works. And so I think that's what we want to try to strive for. You know, we saw this too after 9/11. I was there in Washington. I was part of that. And I watched this country come together in a way it didn't matter what your background was. And I think that's what we need to strive for, is not take politics out of it, but take partisan politics out of it and try to bring together why this is important for all of us. And, you know, that's why I have to say right now, I'm so challenged by the fact that all we want to talk about is, was it a lab leak or was it a spillover? That's all we want to talk about. And we'll never know. Move on. Figure out for both what we're going to do if it's a lab leak and how to prevent it, or it's a spillover. Can we prevent it? Or, and what do we do about it? And that's to me how I'd look at it.
Thank you for your detailed explanations with your experience. Thank you for bringing up the current events as well. Regarding the state of the United States with research and with preparedness, how that is not in a good place right now. Are there other countries stepping up, and could we see their help coming?
Great question. Really an important question. And one that I wish I had better news for. The United States has always led the world in research and discovery, medical research in general. That has brought us a lot of the benefits that we do have today in a public health world. And Europe has been clearly a very important partner in all of that. But if you look what's happened over the course of the past year, we've pulled out of everything virtually internationally. We destroyed the USAID, the Agency for International Development. We have basically pulled back. We're out of, no longer in the WHO, soon to be not anymore. And it's a situation where then how can the rest of the world help, okay? Well, right now in Europe, we're in such a bad way because of Ukraine that all of the EU countries have basically gone from 2 to 3% GDP for defense to 6 to 8%. And that money that used to go into the kind of programs that would support what you were talking about has now been diverted in Europe to defense. And so it's like a double whammy. Besides the U.S. pulling out, the EU's pulling out. China and Russia have never contributed much on a global public health basis. You know, China has done more for inside itself. Russia just does little on anything. And so we're hurting. India is a country that we may be able to count on more in the future. But right now, even there, they're not the answer. So this is an important issue. We need to understand also the next pandemic will not be a country pandemic. It'll be a global pandemic. And we're all going to be in the soup at the same time. And so it really is important. And we're trying to promote that diplomacy as much as we possibly can.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Doctor. I have a question bouncing off from the right side of the room, more specifically about public trust in public health. I mean, when COVID happened, I was in 7th grade and, you know, I had a lot of family in the medical field, but it's more as so there was a generational distrust in government. And so I'm seeing that people in medicine are taking more advice from things they see on Facebook than the actual government giving advice about what happened during the pandemic, which led to a lot of people then being affected by COVID and not knowing what to do. I mean, we took a trip and they made us take the vaccine. And I think that's the only reason some people in my family got the vaccine, to go take trips and go places overseas.
You're hired. I need your name and number, okay? Our center right now has a major initiative looking at social media and all the different types of media. There is not a simple answer. You know, you look at an old white guy like me, and I talk about podcasts that last an hour and a half long. I lose everybody who's in that younger age group, such as yourself, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that podcast has a very important audience. A lot of people who are older like myself who like that kind of format, but that won't sell at all. If you can't get it on X or you can't get it in Blue Sky in 60 seconds, you fail it. And what we have to understand is all the different ways that media plays a role and how it plays a role. And it's not even clear that there is a single media/approach. When interviewing individuals who are reluctant to vaccinate or just adamantly against it, you may find there are people who are that way because, one, they have a friend, neighbor, or family member who has been harmed, they believe, by a vaccine. Two, is because they believe what they've read on the internet is all true, et cetera, et cetera. And you go, and I can go on the laundry list. And each one of these is different. You don't try to relate to that one with the same things you're using on someone else. So we have to understand that the pluralism right now of media and contact, and I'm sure in your business you get it completely that way, you know, from an audience standpoint, who are all the different audiences? How do you relate to them? And so you're 100% right. We need desperately to, at this point, relate to your generation. Why? Because you're also the generation that are going to be giving us the babies over the next few years. And you're going to be confronted head on, what do I do about vaccine? You know, there are very few of us older people who are having kids right now. We may have been grandkids, which are very important, but not older kids. And so I think that this is going to be a major effort over the days and years to come. And this is not just for public health. This is for a whole lot of issues, partisan, economic, et cetera, issues about how do we communicate with all the different individuals in our community.
Going back to where you started, as far as what's going on with the CDC and the vaccine, do you see any possibility that the various medical societies, whether they be obstetricians or whatever, because doctors are scientists, would come forward and say, this is BS and the vaccines need to be used?
Yes, yes, 1,000 times yes. That's my hope. And we're very much in the mix on that right now as I speak to you. This poor guy's had to put up with my phone ringing all day, okay? And that's exactly what we're working on right now. You know, two things that I just have to say. We have a motto at our center, what really has come home to, we've needed a number of times when we've been really feeling despair. And that is, we will bend and we will bend, but we will not break. And we in the medical and public health worlds have to understand how important that is right now. The final piece is, I have a little card that sits on my desk. I read it every morning. I have two things in my life that keep me going besides my wonderful partner up here. And that is, I have a 14-inch electronic picture frame on my desk, and every 30 seconds, new shots, my grandkids come through. Every 30. I never have to wonder why in the hell I'm doing what I'm doing, okay? It's about them. But the second thing is this little card I have in my desk, and it says, the devil whispered into my ear and said, the storm is coming and you're not able to handle it. I whispered in the devil's ear today, I am the storm.
Mike?
You know, it's one thing to say vaccines aren't effective, or they're a conspiracy by the government or whatever in order to build a political coalition or to sell people something. But now that they are in charge and are enacting these things, you know, has the dog caught the car, if you will? Meaning they can't, like, there's going to be repercussions, and they can't just ignore the repercussions. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think how many kids are going to have to die that we can directly attribute it to these actions before somebody suddenly says enough is enough? When is Congress going to take a lead? You know, when is our local leaders going to take a lead? And so I think that the challenge here is that this is not a political debate that somebody will win or lose, for which we'll never really know what win or lose means. Losses here will be deaths. There'll be deaths. And they're going to happen. And they're going to happen more frequently. And, you know, the kid that's going to get hepatitis this next year that wouldn't have normally otherwise gotten it really won't probably be a problem for maybe 20 years, 15 years in terms of when they develop their liver cancer. But when they do, it'll be hell. So I think that that's what we have to keep remembering is that there isn't a outcome that they want other than ideologically to take vaccines off the market. Okay. I mean, they might as well be saying take blue cars off the market or, you know, take Coca-Cola off the market, but we've gone to vaccines. And if you were to listen to the meeting in the last 2 days, and I've been kept up pretty well from my colleagues, it's almost like you can't believe it. I mean, they basically turn the world on its head and say, you know, like I said, a flat earth society now in charge of NASA. You know, it's where they are not truthful. They just totally misrepresent information that they know better. So there's not a motivation there that you can somehow undermine or get to them and say, it's just, I don't know why people are like this. Okay. It'd be like if I looked at all of you today and said, I do not want any of you again ever to have the opportunity to have a good tasting food. I don't want you to have it. You say, well, why? I don't care. I don't want you to. And you say, well, that makes no sense. That's how much sense this makes. And we just have to live with it. But the options are to live with it and to let it happen and to see what's going on, or is to basically take it on and oppose it. And that's what we're up to right now. You know, we're not going to bend. We're not going to break.
Let me punch a little bit above my pay grade and thank Mike Osterholm for his expertise.
Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy Research and of the Innovation Office at University of Minnesota. His new book, published in September, is The Big One is Still Coming, Lessons We Should Have Learned from the COVID-19 Pandemic. We also heard from Dr. Steve Mason. He's a cardiologist and member of the Naples Discussion Group. They partner with Florida Gulf Coast University on the Provost Seminar Series, which this kicked off. Today's recording was a truncated version of our conversation. You can hear it in its entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL. Our show today was produced by yours truly with help from the FGCU technical team. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kinnairy. This is WGCU FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.